court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome with us West Salem High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students are invited to come to oral arguments, and if the invitation is accepted, they are sent briefs of the case we're about to hear, and may have engaged in other activities relating to this case. As part of the program, the students will meet with a justice of this court after this case and will be joined by students who were here for the first two cases, the first case we had. They were Lincoln High School and Williams Bay High School students. Everyone is invited to join with the students at the lunch and discussion with the justice. The discussion will be on the procedure that the court uses to take and decide cases, not the substantive issue of the cases we have heard this morning. Let me now introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Justice Bradley is the justice with whom you will meet after this case is heard. To Justice Bradley's left is Justice David Prosser. To his left is Justice Lewis Butler. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right is Justice Patience Robinsack. I see that Representative Jess Kuitz is in the audience. We're always happy to have a legislator with us. Thank you.
Judge Irwin is
here. Somebody else is here? Judge Irwin's here, too. Is that right? Now, there you are, from Jefferson County, Circuit Court Judge Irwin. Is there anyone else I should introduce? Hearing no further introductions of the audience, I will now call the case and introduce the lawyers to you all. And we have a number. I'll now call 2006 AP66-NM, State versus Bobby G. Arguing on behalf of Bobby G is Attorney James R. Troupas for 25 minutes. Judge Troupas is arguing as pro bono counsel, and the court wants to thank you for so doing, Mr. Troupas. We will then hear from Attorney Adam Levin, who will represent the Milwaukee Children's Court Center in the state of Wisconsin. We'll hear also, that's 15 minutes, and 15 minutes for Attorney Cynthia A. Lipkowski, who is the guardian ad litem from the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee, Inc. And then, Mr. Troupas, you'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. We agree on that? Okay. Attorney Troupas.
May it please the court, I am Jim Troupas, and with my colleague Paul Barbato, we appreciate the opportunity the court has given us to represent Bobby G in this matter. But I'll discuss four items during the course of this oral argument. First, I want to discuss the facts. Then I want to discuss a bit about the statute and the statutory change that occurred that affects this case. Third, I'll discuss due process. And if time permits, we'll discuss a bit about equal protection. The facts of the case are relatively straightforward, but they are important. There was a liaison between Bobby G and Denise in late 2002 or early 2003. Out of that liaison, a child was born in late August of 2003. CHIPS proceedings, a proceeding for protective custody, was begun about 2 weeks later, and TPR proceeding, the termination proceedings, which are the subject of this appeal, began on June 16th of 2004. Bobby G. was not identified as the father to Marquette, the child out of that liaison, until he was first summoned on August of 2004, subsequent to the TPR proceedings, and he was then adjudicated as the father in November of 2004, just about 2 months later, 2.5 months later. A summary judgment was entered, but not entered until September of 2005 on the grounds portion of the termination proceeding. The disposition, the final order, so to speak, was then entered on November the 4th of 2005. The statute involved here is 448.415 sub 6. That's a provision of the statute that provides as an irrebuttable presumption, at least as interpreted by the circuit court, a failure to assume parental responsibility. If there is a failure to assume parental responsibility, then that is grounds for termination of the parent's rights to raise that child, the biological father in this case. The statute prior to 1985 was quite different in pre-87. The statute prior to 1987 provided that the father did not establish a substantial parental relationship with the non-marital child prior to the adjudication of paternity, although the father had reason to believe that he was the father of the child and had an opportunity to establish a substantial parental relationship.
Did Bobby G. have a reason to believe he might be the father?
The only reason he had to believe would have been the fact that he had had a liaison with
him. And he had sexual intercourse one time, and then he did not see Denise for a period of time. Is that correct?
That is correct, but the fact left out is the fact that he attempted on multiple occasions to, in fact, continue the relationship with Denise.
And that was part of the, in the trial before Judge Cooper, that came in, didn't it? I think there was differing testimony, but he had sent a couple of letters. He had sent a pair of shoes that didn't fit. And I think approximately 2 months before, this is factually, he had sent $25 for the care of the child. Let me ask you, because if you want to get the facts here, Bobby G. was the third of the putative fathers that were mentioned by the mother. In other words, they had tested one father, and then he was, in fact, he was the one that accompanied her to the, I think, even to the hospital. And then there was another father that was mentioned, and he didn't test out. So Bobby G., to the best of the knowledge of the state, as I understand the facts, she didn't know it was Bobby G., she just knew it was Bobby. Is that correct?
That is all correct.
And then I just wanted to, so that when he found out, where was he? Where was he? He had been incarcerated, but he was no longer incarcerated, correct?
I don't recall on the record whether he was or was not incarcerated at the time he was identified and appeared in November.
And now I just wanted to bring it up. Now he is, what he did thereafter was what you want to talk about now, what he did to show that he had an interest or an opportunity.
That, in yeah. part, that's true, yes.
Okay. Doesn't concern me, but your argument in your brief is that we look at the Lear case, and there that unmarried fathers have the fundamental rights to their children, where those fathers develop a parental relationship with their children. And the key here, and I think this is what you're trying to say, or will be saying, is that by implication you say that unmarried fathers have a constitutionally protected right of an opportunity to develop. And that's what you're interested in, that there's the opportunity to develop this relationship.
That a court proceeding must take into consideration the opportunity that he would have to do that.
Did Judge Cooper do that?
I don't believe he did at the point in the proceeding that it would have made a difference. In fact,
wasn't that because your client admitted in interrogatories that he could not take care of the child. You know, they admitted in interrogatories, and those were accepted as true by the judge.
He truthfully admitted that, in fact, he had not had a relationship because he did not know that he had a child until after the proceedings began.
Yeah, I want to get to the point, just the point here. Where did, and then the judge let this testimony in about what your client did, and that's where you were going. I wanted to go.
We have one of the interesting things about this record is that, in fact, even though the time at which that evidence would have been relevant, the grounds phase of the proceeding, were completed, and he had ruled based upon the admission that is referred to, he nonetheless gives us a bit of a picture, because he allowed in certain evidence during the dispositional phase, which he then says is irrelevant to his determination because the statute establishes this irrebuttable presumption. So we have a very good record here in the sense of understanding that it is not a wasted exercise for us to address the question of whether or not there are facts which would go to the question of his opportunity to have assumed the responsibility of a father. So we have a unique set of facts there.
Counselor, don't you have to show that this is a constitutional right? Otherwise, there's no requirement in the statute that opportunity has anything to do with the grounds.
Well, in the context of the due process, the process of determining whether or not due process applies, the first step has to be, is this a fundamental right? Or is this something else?
What is this? The opportunity to develop a relationship, correct, that you're talking about?
Well, that's where, forgive me, but I think the nuance comes in because of the nature of the test.
Okay.
As we attempted to state in our briefs, and as I think the several amicus also addressed, the standard is not in question. The fundamental right that we start with is not in question. Lair and this Court have both adopted it. And it's worth it for me to read that, I think. It says, a father has a constitutionally protected liberty interest in his child, provided only that he grasps the opportunity to develop that relationship and accepts some measure of responsibility for the child's future. Biology plus. You can't, it doesn't just spring from the fact that you have offspring. You have to do something that indicates a willingness to be a true parent. So then the question becomes, as it's posed here, well, what if I never have the opportunity because of facts or circumstances that I can or cannot prevent? It doesn't matter which way, but assuming I don't have that opportunity. So the state, if we were to say there is no opportunity included within the statement I just read, then you could literally have the situation, and it would be so, that the state had to acknowledge that a father's parental rights to his child were absolute, could not deny those. But so long as the state could stand in the way of him ever seeing the child or participating with the child, he could prevent him from ever asserting.
Did that happen here? Did that, in this case, and just looking at the facts of this case, Bobby G. Had an opportunity. It wasn't a good opportunity. And my question is, we're talking about the constitutional right. How long does that opportunity go on for?
We don't need to address the question of how long it goes on.
Isn't that important here? Because we're dealing here with the rights of the child, Marquette. He was born 8 weeks early. He suffered from developmental problems such that he needed hospitalization. He needed constant care. And the judge weighs these things. When I looked at the transcript, it seemed that Judge Cooper did weigh and balance this, quote, opportunity as opposed to the rights of the putative father's rights against the child.
If I may separate that question a little bit.
Sure.
Let me take the role of a hypothetical here. If, in fact, Bobby G. had done all of the things that we know he did, parenting classes, attempted to contact the child, attempted to get in touch with him and the like, That would have been, and he had done that in March of 2004. So he participates in the proceeding and he can introduce all of that. But because he is identified shortly after the first phase of the proceedings, but still 11 months before there's a determination, he cannot introduce the evidence that is that same evidence because of the happenstance of time. There is something fundamentally improper about that in our sense of what is fair play.
When we talk about fair play, whose burden is it? Is it the burden of the state to seek out who the father is, or is it the burden of the putative father to at least seek out the person that he had a relationship with and find out whether there was or was not a child?
I think there is some of both. The state clearly takes on the obligation on a regular basis to search out the fathers for reasons that may or may not have anything to do with adoption, but may have to do with many other aspects. So the state takes on that burden regardless. But the individual certainly has some responsibility, and that information ought to be fully disclosed in the record. What did he do? What did he attempt to do? How far did he go in his attempts to become a father to this child? But he's barred from doing so.
Counsel, I need some clarification. I came out today thinking I understood what the issues are, and I'm unsure. One of the issues I understood to be is whether or not there is a constitutional right and the opportunity to establish a substantial relationship. Justice Wilcox asked you that question directly, but you didn't answer that question. Instead, your answer was more nuanced. And let me see if I can find it in my notes. But essentially, when he asked you that question directly, your response was something like, well, did the court erroneously exercise its discretion in not allowing? I'm paraphrasing. And so that gave me a signal that something is going on here that's more nuanced than I anticipated. I anticipated issue. Is there a constitutional right to an opportunity to develop a substantial relationship? So am I wrong? Is it not more nuanced? And if it is more nuanced, help me with that nuance.
Well, in a sense, it's nuanced in the sense, and that's why I read the standard.
Yeah, but
because the standard actually says grasp the opportunity. So necessarily, it presumes the opportunity to some degree. And so I want to be careful in saying that it is somehow a new or different standard.
It may not be new or different, but the real issue is if he didn't have the opportunity to grasp it, has he violated what you view as a father's constitutional right? Is your answer yes?
Yes. The answer would be yes. Yes.
The answer is yes.
Yes.
Can I state it another way?
Sure.
The other way is, does he have a constitutionally protected right for the opportunity to develop a substantial relationship with the child?
As stated, I think it's a bit more difficult, if I understood the way that it was stated, in that the implication of that is that there's some sort of an affirmative obligation on the part of somebody. But the state can't stand in the way of that opportunity.
Can the state terminate the parental rights without giving him an opportunity?
No.
Okay.
Suppose the person committed a rape.
Yes.
Can the state do it without affording sort of full due process to the rapist?
There are compelling reasons, and that is dealt with elsewhere in the statute. For that type of circumstance, where you have, in fact, a compelling reason not to allow that opportunity to go forward, then the statute so provides. Well, it's not before the court here. You certainly would have that kind of circumstance. As in the, yes.
What,
and I think my colleague, Justice Bradley, asked about the fundamental right. And I was starting to discuss this with you, in the trial judge's termination proceeding, he did discuss, and your client was represented by counsel, what his opportunity had been and what he had done. In other words, what I'm concerned about here is the long-term effect of this. And let's say, for example, one of the briefs had the fact that there are literally thousands of young people, children out there, where the putative father has not been ascertained or didn't have the opportunity. What effect on this balancing does that have on Marquette? In other words, do you think he has a fundamental right to a placement in his best interest under the 14th Amendment?
Well, he certainly, the child has certain rights as well as the parent, though I don't think that they're involved here. I mean,
we started out, and I kind of filled in the facts, where you're dealing with a child that had severe developmental problems, has been in a potentially adoptive home for more than 2 years. We're looking at maybe 3 years, and Bobby admits that he said, I need about a year to a year and a half to get my act together to be able to parent this child. But in this whole thing that the judge knew, he knew that Bobby'd already had a termination of a prior child. Mm-hmm. He had a dozen or so criminal matters, which had, for the last 10 years, he had no housing. He had been incarcerated several times, etc. So the judge was weighing these. So I'm just asking, what rights do you think those rights, this fundamental right, which I would ask you, does any other state have this fundamental right?
Yes, we have. We've isolated four different states.
Yes, but are those cases on all fours with the facts of this case?
As a practical matter, there is no case on all fours with the case before the court. But, Your Honor, let me address your comment in two ways, and also the comment of Justice Prosser. In the Zachary B. case, this court found in an incest situation that you could not essentially have an irrebuttable presumption. In that case, it was the mother who was coming to claim rights. You couldn't establish an irrebuttable presumption. Mr. Justice Prosser observes in dissent of that, and I want to talk about that, that it is incredibly important if one is going to place a due process as applied standard into a situation, that it be done with precision. And certainly that is correct. In this situation, under the facts of this case, you have a situation in which the father is identified on a slightly different track than the TPR proceeding. And yet, because of the arbitrariness of this provision of the law, he does not get the benefit of the father's rights being paramount on the grounds phase of the proceeding. It is as if he is not the father, that there was nobody there. He can certainly come in, as he did here, as the judge tried to do here, and say, to take into account, and that's the second half of what I want to get to, that, well, under the circumstances, I probably wouldn't give them to you anyway, because there are all these other factors under the best interests of the child. But let's not confuse those, because if we face the exact same circumstance, and it was not Bobby G, but it was a different person with a different set of personal facts, yet the same procedural context, we might feel very differently about it.
Well, counsel, if I can follow up on your comments and also on Justice Wilcox's question, I'm always concerned with the scope of our decisions and how far-reaching they may be. And I know that we've seen that there are a large number of unwed pregnancies that exist within the state. Do you have any information on how many of these unwed pregnancies would involve putative fathers who have not been identified?
There are – one of the items in one of the amicus is that there were 1,752 situations, according to the CCPA program, that – where the provision of – this provision was invoked, subsection 6, to terminate the father's rights. By the way, that's really important, because what it says is the due process violation that we're talking about here may indeed affect a lot more fathers than we know. So while on the one hand one would say, oh my goodness, this is a terrible thing, we're going to have to look at these. On the other hand, this suggests that perhaps fathers are being terminated willy-nilly in various circumstances. I don't know that.
Counselor, can I draw you back a little bit to the facts of this particular case? This was a one-night stand where these folks didn't know each other. They had sexual intercourse once, and a child was resulting. And you are asking us to take that situation and from it to transcribe constitutional rights for this man who engaged in unprotected sex. Certainly he knew the opportunity to have a child was a possibility. Why doesn't he bear some responsibility for not taking care of what he was doing that evening more than he has, and now coming before the court and asking for constitutional protection for the creation of a child with a woman that he didn't even know?
Because regardless of our personal feelings about his conduct, our system, as a matter of fair play and fundamental fairness, would at least allow him to present those facts. We know the facts that Your Honor has described, but we do not know all of the facts surrounding that night or the subsequent events, because they were entered at best as an afterthought during the secondary portion of this proceeding.
Why is it unfair, given the circumstances, to give his rights similar shrift to those rights that were talked about in Lair, where the court clearly stated that biological parentage is not sufficient for a constitutional right? You are asking us to give a constitutional right based solely on biological parentage. The constitutional right you're asking for is the opportunity to show that he was not an unfit parent, correct?
I don't believe that Your Honor has correctly stated the due process as it would apply here. Because
you're challenging this statute facially, which means it can't be unconstitutional at all to anybody, and you're challenging it as applied. I thought you were making two challenges here.
That is correct. We indicate that it would be appropriate, I think, to challenge it on its face. The argument thus far has certainly been as applied.
Well, are you withdrawing your challenge on its face?
No.
All right. Well, then I go back to my former statement.
No. Because the concept, if one were to weigh that admitting evidence when a father is known during the course of a proceedings as against whatever, the burden is insignificant compared to the denial of a father's right to present
that kind of information. But there has to first be a right established to have the opportunity, and I find no case that says the father has a constitutional right to establish an opportunity.
Well, I think that it is correct to say that there is no explicit grant of the opportunity. It is, however, the necessary result, in our view, of the Lair decision and the Constitution. It has not been posed, to our knowledge, to the U.S. Supreme Court, nor to this Court before today.
Right,
so the question then becomes one of how does one establish that? And to do that, one must weigh the relative situation. If one were to ask the question as we have done today, on whether or not by the way, it's posed in Michael H., which is a subsequent Supreme Court case where they indicate they assumed the opportunity. If you do not grant some form of opportunity, then you are assuming a fiction.
But, Counselor, doesn't the opportunity have to be balanced with the circumstances that created this child? If these people had lived together for 2 years and she left him, and at the time she left him she was pregnant,
To me, that's a very different circumstance for two folks having intercourse and neither one of them knew the other one and they don't see each other again. And you have a child that comes out of it. So to me, whether you have a right or not a right, and you're talking about fundamental fairness, you have to look at the fairness on both sides of the equation, how the child was created and what he wants to establish. I don't think either one operates in a vacuum from the other. Do you?
I think that's right. I think that's why the due process right we are speaking of here is to present the evidence that relates to the very question that Your Honor has asked, to deny the opportunity to present that evidence.
We're talking about a different question, but that's...
When do you think the opportunity begins?
Not necessary to address that here, because as applied in this circumstance, the opportunity begins at the point in which, in this instance, the opportunity to present the evidence began when he is identified, and they will address it as they have in this state, going back to the time of the beginning of the pregnancy. That is, they evaluate whether or not, this court's evaluated whether or not the party had in fact helped in, during the course of the pregnancy, lived with the mother, helped in the delivery. So in that sense, what the court would be looking at would be from the point of conception forward. That would be the area they would look at. That's what we're referring to.
If someone doesn't do anything from the moment of conception to the moment of birth, and the sort of right for an opportunity doesn't spring into existence until after birth, aren't we sort of putting a rubber stamp on just deplorable policy of one-night stands, reckless sexual conduct, and then vindicating the right of the person doing that to say, now I want my rights.
Right.
Put in the reverse, who are we to exercise that moral judgment in the reverse? We only ask as a judicial system and as due process that the parties be allowed to present their evidence that, in fact, he had attempted to assume the responsibility over this
child. If there
were
no child at issue here and it were just two people, I could buy your argument. But you've got a child out there that needs a home and someone to care for him who's now 3.5 years old.
And in this instance, there would have been no impact one way or the other on that child. Had the evidence been introduced and considered at the grounds phase of these proceedings, we might fully expect that the disposition of this case would be exactly the same as it is today. And that's why at the beginning, one looks at the timetable in which these are occurring, there is no justification for denying the allowance of that evidence.
Also, and I know the red light's on, but have you thought about...
I covered it up, Your Honor. I don't. I apologize.
It's a good try.
Purposeful on my part.
You know, I could see it underneath the book. My question is, and I guess Justice Rogenczak and perhaps Justice Prosser raised this, the impact of what you're asking to find this fundamental right, and I accept that in many cases it would be meritorious, but what I have difficulty with, because each putative father has this right, everybody, so when you have people that aren't able to, or you don't know the father, but then come in 5 years later, with DNA, and they've been out of touch, incarcerated, out of the country, etc. What happens to the children of this situation? What are their rights? Are they held in limbo, or are they held hostage? What about that?
The statute already provides that once adoption decrees are entered, which would be the circumstance I suspect we're talking about, although you could perhaps not have an adoption, you could have still a foster situation. It's extraordinarily difficult. If not impossible to reopen it, and that isn't before the court.
Well, what I'm saying is that, but if the father is identified, or the parent, then everything sits there so that the person can either perform or not perform. So the person does not perform, who suffers? Does the child suffer? Or does, in other words, Bobby G needs a year and a half. Ray may need 2 years. Somebody may need more time. In the meantime, these people, these children are sitting there in a very difficult position where they have bonded, possibly, as in this case, what do you do then?
Well, I mean, in those particular circumstances, the court will take that into consideration during the course of the proceedings. But that does, by the same token.
But the point is, the proceeding takes place, and the court says, now you have a fundamental, if you're arguing your fundamental right has been violated, we'll have to give you an opportunity.
I don't think this case poses that question. There may be someday that question posed to the court, but the question here is where the father has been identified during the course of the proceedings, and it is the father, and is able to present that kind of evidence that would be relevant to the question of grounds, he ought to be allowed to do that. There ought not be an irrebuttable presumption attached to the day that the petitions are filed.
You seem to be, okay, I know the red light's on. My colleagues are going to come over here, and I criticize some of them, all of them, for running over. I've done it myself. I apologize, and that's my last question.
It's not mine.
Oh, okay. Well, then I reserve the right to ask more.
I believe every person in my law firm says I talk too much, so I'm fine.
Mr. Troupas, what's the statute that you cite about the difficulty of opening up an adoption?
My apologies, Your Honor.
I asked, what was the statute you referred to about the difficulties of opening an adoption?
I apologize. I don't have that citation in front of me.
Maybe your colleague will give that
out.
Thank you. We'll now hear from Attorney Adam Levin, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. And while it's fresh in my mind, I believe it's 48.46 is the statute. May it please the Court. My name is Adam Levin. I'm an assistant district attorney from Milwaukee County, and I represent the respondent, the state of Wisconsin, in this matter. I'm here today to ask this Court to rule that a father's duty to parent is triggered by the volitional creation of a child, not by the onset of an unwed father's actual awareness of his offspring. I'm asking this Court to affirm the decisions of the Court of Appeals and the trial court and hold that the termination of Bobby G's parental rights was constitutional. The nature of an unwed father's interest in his child is set forth in a line of Supreme Court cases, including Stanley from 1972, Quilloin from 1978, Caban, 1979, and the latest and most definitive case is the Lair case from 1983. I believe all the lawyers in their briefing also cited the Michael H. case, which is sometimes called the fifth case in that string of cases. But for this matter, the Lair case is controlling.
Also, can I ask you then, and this is cited in your opponent's brief, page 15, and it says unmarried fathers have fundamental rights. I don't think there's any of us that disagree with that. The next statement is, the necessary implication of Lear is that unmarried fathers have a constitutionally protected right to an opportunity to develop such relationships. And then he says that any statute that is involved with this must be analyzed under strict scrutiny. What is your position on that?
My position is that the U.S. Supreme Court has never articulated that right.
Has our court or another state court?
I believe that this court has never articulated that right. Sister courts, other state courts, have found a constitutionally protected opportunity to develop a relationship. And responding to Justice Bradley's queries of opposing counsel, you know, what's the nuance? Is there a right? Is there not a right? The way I believe that the Lair decision, as construed by other jurisdictions looking at these facts, is that the biological opportunity to be a father to a child has a time variable which is incredibly quickly burning. It is a burning wick that expires very quickly.
Mr. Levin, let me ask you about a decision that was made by this court last term, Kenosha County versus Jody W. Now, it's certainly not on all fours with this case, but it's centered around the opportunity to develop a relationship, the opportunity to meet parental responsibilities for a woman who was in prison. And this court basically said you can't terminate the parental rights of a person under those circumstances. How do you distinguish the opportunity issue that was in that case and the opportunity issue that's in this case? Why are they different?
Your Honor, the and I apologize because this doesn't directly answer your question, but maybe I will by the time I'm done speaking.
Just keep going.
The fundamental difference between Jody W. in this case is that Jody W. had a perfected constitutional interest in the ongoing relationship with her child. Mm-hmm. She gave birth to her child. I believe the child was 5 years old or so, or maybe more, by the time the child was detained. The child was detained exclusively because of the child's mother's change in circumstances. That is a very different case from Jody W., and so when the court reviewed the application of the continuing need of protection ground, I think it's subsection 2 of, when the court reviewed the continuing need of protection ground, it properly analyzed that those facts and the application of that statute under a strict scrutiny basis. Bobby G. has no such perfected right in the ongoing relationship with his child, with his biological child, Marquette. The court therefore looks at the statute and its application to him in a different manner.
How do you perfect the right?
By being a father. And
well, if that's correct, doesn't he have a perfected right then? He was the father.
Well, he was the biological father. I'm sorry. Under Lehr, the language that they use is not the exact language that they use is not before me in my notes, but something to the effect of being willing and able to bear some measure of responsibilities for that child's future. So a father, and I believe that when we look at the cases that other courts have looked at for opportunity, that other courts have described as the opportunity interest cases, those are cases. Well, let me back up. Prior to Lehr, throughout the 1970s, the language that was used in terms of an unwed father's interest in his child was the language of custody. And that's not in the sense of legal custody that a court orders, but sense of custody and sense of living with the child, having an ongoing relationship with the child.
Counsel, one of the challenges of sitting on this bench is to realize that the law that we are interpreting and applying applies to every citizen. It applies to a 56-year-old woman who drives a Lexus. It applies to a 48-year-old guy who drives a Ford pickup truck. It applies to someone who's still driving an Edsel. It applies to everyone. Let me take the facts and apply it to me and my family with a little hypothetical, a little hypothetical, or a lot of hypothetical, I hope. Let's say I, living in Wausau, Wisconsin, have 5 kids, and one of my kids is Peter, and Peter is 23 years old. Nice guy, good looking, just finished college, has a bright future ahead of him, okay? And Peter has, as your opposing counsel would call, a liaison. And he did, and it, and he was not, just like here now, and I'm going to return to these facts, he was not aware of the birth of the child until after the termination of parental rights petition was filed. That's when he was first aware of it. You know, mom didn't know or mom didn't want to tell anyone, but Anyway, Peter wasn't aware of it. So now Peter becomes aware of it. Termination, just like here, petition has been filed, and it asserts that he has failed to assume responsibility. Here I am, a grandmother. And I say to you, what do you mean Peter has failed to assume responsibility? He was never told of it. This is his child. This is my grandchild. Shouldn't he? And so then Peter, as the good, responsible kid who went to grade school, high school, college, and post-college, shouldn't he then be, and he, so he says, okay, this is my kid. You know, I didn't realize it, but I'm going to start paying child support. And his mother says, you bet you are, Peter, and you're going to pay the, you know. And he's going to start sending presents to the kids, and he's going to try to make every attempt he can to establish a relationship with that child. Now, you're telling me that because parenthood was created at the moment of conception, and because he failed to assume responsibilities, even though he had no idea that he was a father or a child, maybe even was born, as happens in some situations. Too bad, so sad. Save your $500 a month or $1,000 a month child support, Peter. Save the love that you would like to put towards your child. Save the opportunity that you could give this child for his future life and education. Because we're going to live with this fiction that you failed to assume your responsibilities even though you didn't know it. So tell me how you respond to my Peter and me as a grandmother.
Your Honor, I would say that for the grounds phase, the analysis would be, sadly, as for Bobby G., exactly the same, that a father who is not there, who does not provide for his child's needs, material, financial, yeah, emotional.
Let me give you the same fact situation, but with the case I had when I was a circuit court judge. And that was someone else's Peter, someone else's John, or someone else's Bill. Huh? And the mother knew likely who the father was. But, you know, in a lot of situations, people come up with, you know, life is cumbersome. We've got odd facts in people's lives. And the mother didn't want to know. The mother intentionally kept it from that man. The petition was filed. So here, I'm introducing into your fact situation a little bit of, maybe fraud is too strong of a term, but something that smells a little bit like fraud. Mom knows Bill is the father. Mom doesn't want anything to do with Bill anymore. Mom hates Bill. In fact, Mom's onto a new relationship with Al. At least the last thing in the world she wants is this Bill guy back in her life. So she doesn't tell him, she doesn't tell anyone at all until it's time to come to court. Now how do you, when you have this active subterfuge going on, do you still take this purist point of view that no, parental responsibility, even though she lied, cheated, stealed, and schemed? How do you do that?
The first thing I'll begin my response with is saying that is not this case. There's no evidence of fraud, deceit, or what the guardian ad litem has characterized in her brief as the string of thwarted father cases.
That's right. But if it were, is my hypothesis.
But if it were a thwarted father case, it would be an as-applied due process challenge to the statute, and it would be very fact-intensive. It would there be a variable. The most important variable, I believe, to look at would be the variable of time. Is it, as in Marquette's case, a 10-month-old child when the petition is filed, in which case there's a much different analysis than with a newborn, because for 10 months, there's the 10-month period this child was alive, there's a 9-month period this child was the gestational period, 8 months in Marquette's case, he was born prematurely. But those would be the variables that would be looked at, and on those facts, Your Honor, I simply would have to see it to know whether it would impact my analysis. In a case where there's no, such as this, where there's no evidence of any any thwarting, or in the hypothetical, your first hypothetical, where a father is simply not there, he is statutorily unfit. He can defend in the second phase of saying, as in this case, although I'm statutorily unfit, I afford my child a future, and then the court would weigh the child's needs in the best interest of the child. But the first phase of unfitness would be met in your first hypothetical, and for your second hypothetical, I suppose I would just need to see it to know.
Counsel, if we recognize that this is the fundamental right that Justice Bradley is talking about for Bobby G., how would that affect Marquette in this case? In other words, I guess what I'm asking is, do we care about that? Are we interested in the effect on the child, or do we place our emphasis on the, quote, the opportunity that the father, if he has an opportunity to parent? So who do we look at? Do we look at both? We just look at one?
Your Honor, the amicus and the guardian ad litem advocate for a far more child-centered view of this issue than heretofore the recent case law has recognized. So I suppose I'd answer that question that under the current case law, using the current analyses that that is available to this court, with everybody's rights in play, the rights of the father or the rights of the parent balanced against the standards of unfitness and the compelling interests in achieving permanency for child welfare, the result in this case is that Marquette's permanency remains fixed. This court accords even greater weight, and I see my time has expired, but if I may complete this
thought. You may
thought,
finish.
And that if this court affords a greater constitutional analysis than this court has articulated so far, at least in my reading of the cases, then I believe that certainly Marquette's permanency remains intact. But even under the existing statutory scheme, constitutional analysis and case law, Marquette's permanency should remain intact, and I ask this court to affirm the decisions of the trial court and the Court of Appeals in this matter.
If I might.
Mr. Butler.
Mr. Levin, I want to ask you the same question I asked of Mr. Troupas, because I'm concerned with the impact of this decision and how far it might reach. When I asked Mr. Troupas this question, he gave me the answer of 1750. I want to know if that's accurate under your assessment or inaccurate. But the question, since we know that there are a large number of unwed pregnancies in the state, and particularly in Milwaukee County, where this case comes from, do we have any idea, do we have any knowledge of how many putative fathers might be affected who do not at this time know that they're a father, given the circumstances of this case? Do we have any idea how broad this reaches?
The only thing I can give the court is my anecdotal, my caseload. In my caseload, and I haven't done a count, but I would say it's somewhere between 15 to 30% of my cases, which are exclusively termination of parental right cases. So I'm not talking about the window of the CHIPS cases, which is a much greater number. Those get, you know, there many fewer of those become TPRs than don't. So I would say that of the cases that become termination of parental rights cases, anecdotally, I would tell you about 15 to 30% of my cases involve fathers who are not identified or are only identified by first name and no identifiable characteristic otherwise.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Attorney Lipkowski, guardian ad litem.
Please, the court. I am Cynthia Lipkowski, appearing for the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee as guardian ad litem for Marquette. The Legal Aid Society is guardian ad litem for about 80% of the children in Milwaukee County in Chapter 48 cases who need guardian ad litems. There are several points I'd like to further discuss with the court this morning. Some of them are extensions of what you've already heard. At this point, I think it's conceded, first of all, that Bobby G. is asking you to go where no other appellate court has gone. There is no court on an appellate level that has found a constitutionally protected right in the circumstance of a man who's had a one-night stand with a woman he barely knows.
Let me ask, because I'll tell you, it still is not completely clear exactly what right we're talking about.
I agree with you as well.
May I just kind of interject a question? Let me ask, can you live with this? Where, comma, as here, comma, which means, of course, it's an applied. When the father doesn't know, is not advised until after the petition terminating parental rights has been filed. And when I say as here, I mean the abandonment and all this sort of stuff. Then the court should give him an opportunity to be able to present evidence on the issue of abandonment.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, in response to certain questions asked by the court, Mr. Troupas has indicated in the court proceeding, it must take into consideration whether or not the dad had the opportunity to develop a relationship and be able to present that evidence. He also says the due process right is the right to be able to present evidence. So I'm not talking about then. It's a little bit different than the focus of, you know, does the father, biological father, have a constitutionally protected right to the opportunity to develop a relationship? That's a different issue than, whereas here, does he have a due process right to be able to present evidence?
On the issue of opportunity.
On the issue of opportunity and abandonment, which go hand in hand, I think.
And you're applying this to the abandonment ground. I mean, abandonment
yes,
already
right.
has a defense of good cause, so that probably covers some of what you're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
The failure to assume ground, as in this case, though, is very different.
Failure to assume.
Right. Failure to assume is very different ground. No, I don't think he has any right to present the issue of opportunity. I think the first characterization of opportunity that you had is the one that is, Lair doesn't give you that opportunity. I think Lair says you have, as I believe you indicated, Justice, the opportunity that's presented by your biological link, and either you use it or you don't. And time is a factor in all these opportunity cases. The opportunity that's being discussed here is the opportunity to say why I didn't do anything. I didn't know I had a child and what I did after the fact. I think the bottom line through much of the discussion this morning is we as a society want to hold fathers responsible. We want fathers to be involved in their children's lives. And they need to meet the standard of providing some type of parenting to their children, or in the instance of a termination of parental rights and fair to assume, they are unfortunately out in the cold in this respect. It's not for the state to have to tell the father, you're the dad. The dad should know that already.
Ms. Lepkowski, here's part of the problem with the argument that you just made, as I see it. You point out, and I think accurately so, that society wants fathers to be responsible. That's what society wants. We have, as a practical matter, a case where a putative father simply does not know he is the father. We know that that situation is a lot broader than this case. There are a number of putative fathers that are out there who just simply don't know they're the father. Now, if we as a society want them to take responsibility and become the fathers that they can become, how do we fulfill that interest by cutting off the interest? That's the concern that I have. If you want them to take responsibility and you have someone who's willing to say, I'm willing to take responsibility, then how does it further that interest to say, but you can't tell us that, you're too late?
And in this case, that it is, you're too late. If this would have happened earlier in these proceedings, if father number three would have been identified as something other than Bobby during the CHIPS proceeding, then Bobby G would have been in a very different situation, obviously. We want parents to get involved in children's court cases. We want fathers to get adjudicated. We may open up family resources by doing that. But the state's limited in what they can do. In this case, they had dad number one named. He and the mother had signed a voluntary paternity acknowledgement. That's an adjudication. The state looked beyond that, and in Milwaukee we do, and say, well, there was no genetic testing. Let's do a genetic test. We can swab you right here at the courthouse. Let's go do that. That's how important of a value we place on trying to find fathers and adjudicating them. Then it was dad number two. No, it turned out not to be dad number two. Who else is there? Well, Bobby. Well, that's all we had to work with. And unfortunately, in this case for Bobby, it does put him out in the cold. But on the other hand, we have Marquette.
But before you go to Marquette, here's my question. As soon as you find out it's Bobby, and this is the concern that I have about the argument that's being made here, as soon as you find out that it's Bobby, as I understand the facts, and correct me if I'm wrong, Bobby says, okay, what do I do? How do I do this? While he's incarcerated, he takes parenting classes. He tries to develop, at least he wants to try to develop, as I understand the facts, a relationship, and he's simply unable to do so because of the situation. So I guess my concern is at what point does one grasp that opportunity? If knowledge is not an aspect of this, if knowledge has nothing to do with this, are we creating some sort of form of strict liability that as it deals with the question of parentage? That's the concern that I have. I mean, I think we all want parents to take responsibility. At what point does the parent lose that opportunity?
Let me ask.
I'd like to answer my question, Justice Lopez. Okay.
I think the new registry statute in some way articulates the issue. It explicitly states that a non-marital father is on notice that if he engages in sexual intercourse and a pregnancy results, there could be a TPR, and therefore you better protect your rights. There's no one but the father that can take this action to protect his rights. You have an obligation in creating a child to take care of that child, nurture that child, and if you don't, someone else may. You know, in this case, it was a CHIPS case first. We had a child who was very much special needs and a mother, Denise, who just couldn't do it. Denise had a whole raft of problems of her own. I mean, Bobby found a woman to father, as it happened, to father his child, who just wasn't someone who could parent. And if he knew anything about her and asked where her children were and found out how many children she had, he would have found out a little bit more of the type of mother she was. But we have to assign, I think, it's a policy consideration. Where do we assign obligation here? The cases that this comes up in the most difficult fashion in the continuum of cases that have been discussed and argued in the briefs are the issues of the thwarted fathers. There are thwarted fathers, as Justice Bradley was bringing up. What do we do with them? Well, it's very much a case-by-case analysis, I think. And if it's a newborn child, that analysis is different than if the child is 5 or 10. What if Marquette was 10? How would that change the analysis?
Counsel, I want to ask Justice Crooks had a question on the Jody case. And he was asking, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think he was asking, well, what's the difference between this case and Jody? That involved the mother. There had been a relationship. Is that the difference, where there has been a relationship?
That is how I would answer that.
Then if you have the situation, and this is a question Justice Butler is asking, all right, if you don't have a chance, how do you, let's say, invoke the responsibility? But here's my question. If a father, for whatever reason, incarceration, inability to get back to the state, whatever, but you know he knows he has a child, there has to be some limitation on the time, doesn't there? In other words, if he's in prison for 10 years and we know he has a child and he cannot take advantage of the opportunity, is the answer obvious?
Well, we're talking about that in the context of termination of parental rights
right.
as well.
Yes.
It depends on the circumstances of the case. I mean, here we're looking for permanence for children who are in foster care in this particular case, and we don't want them to stay there forever. If the father's in prison for 10 years, it's a different situation than a father who's in prison for 6 months. And that's factored into the best interest consideration, obviously. And Wisconsin has this two-part process so that we take those issues into account in the second part of the case. And in some of those instances, there'd never be a TPR petition brought up in the first place.
Counsel, you were starting out by indicating that Mr. Troupas has been asking us to go where no appellate court has gone before. Now, I looked at pages 46 through 50 of his brief, where he cites us to cases from Oklahoma, Kansas, Iowa, and Illinois. How do you distinguish those cases?
The cases were, at times, the courts have found more likely to find to be sympathetic to the father and perhaps to overturn an adoption, for example, or termination petition, were those of the thwarted fathers. Bobby's more what's called a pop-up or a disappearing father. The other class is the thwarted fathers. The thwarted fathers are individuals who were prevented from doing whatever they wanted to do to establish a parental relationship by the mom who lied and said the child died, state action, an adoption agency who didn't act appropriately. They're a different class in a sense on this continuum of dads. And those are the type of dads, I think, those are the type of cases that are discussed in our briefs where the courts sometimes give that consideration and sometimes not. And sometimes the courts still say, you know, it's too bad that she lied to you, but in this instance, in this case, given the child's circumstances and the age of the child often and the fact that there may be in a step-parent case, for example, a family relationship already, you're still out in the cold. Those cases are very much determined on the particular facts of a case, and I think those are the cases you're referring to.
Let me see if I can understand the position. The position is that there is no constitutional right for a father to have an opportunity to parent the child or have a relationship with the child. So that here, father doesn't know there's a child, there's no opportunity for the father, therefore, to have a relationship with the child. Therefore, there is no relationship with the child for the time period. Therefore, there is grounds for termination of the father's. There are grounds for termination under the statute.
Yes.
By summary judgment, because he fesses up that he's met the statutory requirements, right?
Right. I would say that his opportunity is passed.
Well, his opportunity is passed because the statute says he's got a 1 year or whatever that time period is. So the judge then in the first phase would say there are grounds for termination, right? Now we're in the second phase on disposition, and there it is a question of even if there are grounds, is it the best interest of the child to terminate? And here the father says, I love the kid. This can be Bobby G. It can be Peter. It can be anybody. I really have always wanted a child. I am able and willing to take care of the child. It may take me a year if I'm in jail. It may take me no time if I'm in graduate school because my mother is going to, wealthy as she is from her salary as a judge, is going to take care of the child. So we have, there may be no means, or we do have the means to take care of this child, and that we really appreciate the foster parents who have obviously done a fantastic job with a child that needs an enormous amount of attention. And but now that's where the court weighs it all, right?
Yes.
And if the father doesn't have the means, it's going to take another year before the father is going to be in a position because of incarceration to deal with the child, judge might say, we're terminating, right? That's your position. That's this case.
It's more than lack of means. It's
okay, yeah. Well, it's not only lack of means. It's not a financial thing. Father is going not going to be able to really have a substantial relationship for a year if the father's incarcerated, right?
Okay.
So your position is no constitutional right to opportunity, right?
Correct.
You can have, if you meet the paper requirements of the statute, that's grounds, summary judgment grounds, and the ability of the father to really parent is taken into account on the second ground of disposition, and there the best interests of the child are paramount.
Correct.
Therefore, affirm. That's a good summary of your argument.
In this case, yes.
Mm-hmm. In another case, you'd still have the grounds would be there. Correct. You may have a different disposition or a different argument on the disposition.
Yes.
It's my understanding, counsel, that the statute that we're talking about or focusing on, primarily 48.415.6, was amended 20 years ago to take out opportunity to establish a substantial parent relationship. Can you give us any insight into what was going on 20 years ago?
Yes. I believe that occurred probably because of the Lehr line of cases. It was after Lehr, and it seems to be specifically dealing with issues that were addressed there as far as opportunity. The other part of that is the fiscal note that has been referenced in our brief referred to speeding up adoptions, and frankly, that was a very important goal at that time because there weren't very many termination parental rights cases going on at that point in time as well. But I believe that it probably was a result of Lehr.
Now, I probably agree with you that there's no case directly on point about this, but there's certainly, in the fact situation of several cases, and in the language of the courts, it seems to me that a good argument can be made that the opportunity of a father to be a parent or have a substantial parental relationship is recognized in these cases in some way in the language, even though you and I may have a hard time pinpointing it. Do you agree with
yes,
that?
Yes, I agree. I agree in some of the cases that yes, that's correct.
You can pull out the language
right.
That says that, and cases have come pretty close. I was reading Professor Meyer's article in the Arizona Law Review, and makes a good argument that you can pull out some of that language.
Yes, I think that's the case, and time. Time is the big constant in all those cases. How much time has passed? How old is a child?
And whether there's been an actual adoption.
Yes.
You're kicking it, like the New York case,
right.
Where you had an adoption, and then you're trying to upset an adoption. It seemed to me I found that New York case very persuasive. But when you're in the process of the termination, you might have different considerations.
And that's what most of those cases talked about, adoption cases.
That's right.
Mother did a written consent, and the father was unaware or not involved.
That's why I asked for that citation about kicking over the adoptions. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Troupas? What's your strongest argument, Mr. Troupas?
Oh, they're all strong. Right?
You love all your children. Pick one.
Because I'm in the state of Wisconsin Supreme Court, let me look to two cases from this court which I think command the outcome. The first is the Jody W. case referred to a minute ago. There, the court did, in fact, look at what would be a legitimate objective of the termination provisions of Wisconsin's statute. That, to me, is the operative part of that case, because it says it is to protect children from unfit parents. It's very important, because we're talking about the first phase. If we are going to take away the rights of a parent to their child, there is nothing more fundamental to us than to raise our biological offspring.
Now, isn't Jody is certainly distinguished from this case. There was a relationship. It had been ongoing. No relationship here. So why isn't that different? Is it just because we recognize? Now, I was, as I recall, I wrote a dissent in that case. But
I recall that.
Not a very long one. It's very good, my colleagues told me it was very long. But the point is that if you wanted to distinguish, you're talking, how does that give us the, it's just about opportunity there?
Well, it is certainly, it's a different set of facts. But ultimately, the question becomes the opportunity. And how does the statute's objective, the legitimate objective of the termination statute, how is that advanced in any way as against the simple right to present the proofs here? And the second case that drives the outcome in this court, cases, is the Zachary B. case. Because it says that there is a sense of fair play, a sense of fundamental justice that goes into being able to present evidence in front of a trier of fact, and that an irrebuttable presumption comes to this court very suspect. That's also the rule at the Supreme Court level as well. The first Stanley case, that's exactly what drove that case as well, the irrebuttable presumption that simply because you were unwed, you were unfit.
Also, I want to present to you another evidentiary case. A few years back, there was a case that came to this court, In Re CAS and CDS. This was a man who alleged he was the father of two children born during a lawful marriage to another man. And he petitioned to have blood work taken of himself, the child, and the mother, to prove his paternity. The trial court determined it was contrary to the child's best interest to have blood tests taken, and they were precluded. And there was a constitutional challenge brought all the way to this court, which we sustained and said there was no constitutional right on his behalf. How is that not key to what we're doing here?
Well, I think that particular case involved the concomitant right and obligation of society to honor the marital relationship. And the U.S. Supreme Court as well has said the same thing in its cases, where the Michael H. case was right on the same point, was that if there's a marital relationship, and now we have a third party intruding upon that, the goal, the objective of in that situation to protect that relationship overcomes anything else.
But if, in fact, in my recollection is that we did not find there was a fundamental right on behalf of WWW, who was the punitive father in Re CAS and CGS. And we didn't find that there was that kind of constitutional right in that case. So we weren't balancing any kind of a constitutional right to protect marriage against any constitutional right of the punitive father. It was a very different playing field. There was no constitutional right identified. I mean, you're asking us to find one.
I can't, having not participated in the case, I don't know why it was or was not addressed or why it was not brought to the court during that case. That case drove, as I understood it, on the traditional relationships which are given great deference in our society, and
that's,
that drove that
that's
case.
That's true, but WW raised the specter that he had a constitutional right to have his paternity determined.
And again,
so he didn't get the opportunity even to present any evidence.
I would, with all deference, there's the dissent by Justice Scalia in the Michael H. case went to some of the same traditional concepts that in fact faced with two conflicting, very traditional and important goals of society. They're protecting the marital relationship and whatever rights the father may have. We're not going to recognize the father's rights. Again, it can be argued that this court's decision in that was consistent with the Lair case in that the the state didn't stand in the way of the opportunity, but it wasn't itself going to enhance that opportunity by forcing him into those proceedings. So my problem is that I didn't see that case by this court as addressing the question now before the court.
Well, it addresses the evidentiary question, and I go back to Justice Bradley's question to you, is what is the right we're talking about, the right to present evidence, or is it the right to have an opportunity aside from whether you're presenting evidence about it or not? And I seem to hear you arguing that it was both, but perhaps I was incorrect about the evidentiary one.
I apologize if I misinterpreted the court's opinion in that. The problem, not the problem, but the explanation of that case from my perspective is that these traditional values that are protected in a marital relationship are certainly an overpowering part. And the Michael H. case in Supreme Court also affected that same principle. So I did not see that particular case that Your Honor mentioned as necessarily forcing a result. Whereas the other two, particularly on the questions of fundamental justice, do drive it.
Thank you. Justice Bradley has a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Counsel, what right are you asserting your client has here today?
He has the fundamental right to the opportunity. He has the father's right, has a constitutionally protected liberty interest in the child, and he has the right to the opportunity to develop that relationship to the degree that he may present proofs during the course of a proceeding to demonstrate whether he has or has not taken advantage of that. It is I must be very careful here, because we are limited to the facts of this case. It is as applied here, where the party is a participant in the proceedings during the course of those proceedings. He's been identified. He is a participant.
Your position would be that any time you have this kind of fact situation during the pendency of the termination of parental rights, father comes in, this is his first discovery that he has a child, that he be given the opportunity to develop a relationship with the child. That's
it. Given an opportunity to present proofs that he could, that's a correct statement, Your Honor, in the sense that the proofs that he will present are that he would be able to do so. Necessarily, he hadn't done so before he got there because he did not know of the child.
The opportunity,
yes.
Right.
Yes.
And he should be given the opportunity.
Yes.
You have to be careful how you state it, because if it's the fact that he can develop such a relationship, you've got a guy who's in prison now, or was, right? And limited ability to develop a relationship for yet one more year. Is that something that the court takes into account? Or is the fact that he never had the opportunity to develop such a relationship the only thing the court takes into account?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, it makes a lot of difference, because in this particular case, he never had the opportunity. Then you just say, okay, we're going to stop this proceeding now. You got time now. You develop this relationship. I'll see you all in 6 months, 8 months, 2 years, whatever. Or the court says, you say you want to develop a relationship. We don't think you can develop such a relationship because you are in prison or whatever. You're in the army and you're in Iraq. I don't care what the point is. This kid can't stand another year without a family and permanency. So, sorry, buddy, you're out. Which is it? I mean, I've sort of made a simple dichotomy, and life is not that simple. But if you take my two examples, what are you arguing for?
The father's rights are paramount in the grounds phase.
The first
one. And
thus
the father's rights would
And then he has an opportunity to be given the opportunity, no decision yet. Is that your position?
That would be correct.
Okay.
Well, thank you again, Your Honors, and we appreciate, again, the opportunity to have represented Bobby G. here.
Well, the court thanks you for your willingness to spend a great deal of time and effort of yours and the firm, and what you get for that is intense questioning and hostility.
Mr. Troupas, thank you, and thank the firm very much. And Mr. Troupas understands that it's only through this kind of questioning that the court can help resolve a very, very difficult case. And thanks to all counsel for presenting this difficult case. That closes the hearing on 2006 AP 66 MM State versus Bobby G. The court is in recess until 1:30 when it hears the third case. The students should remain here. Justice Bradley will be out shortly. We're in recess.